Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. Going back some way now in human history, people have dreamed about creating machines that would perform like human beings. In fact, some cases those weren't dreams, they were nightmares. And while that day may yet be some way off, our guest for this morning, author Lee Goodkin, says that the advances in the field of robotics that we've seen in the past decade have gone far beyond the expectations of all but the wildest dreamers. In this part of our show, we'll talk a little bit about some of the people and some of the work on the cutting edge of robotic technology as we talk with the author of a recent book that's titled Almost Human, Making Robots Think. That's the subtitle. It is published by W.W. Norton. Our guest, Lee Goodkin, is the author of many books. He's also the editor of Creative Nonfiction. That's the first literary journal to publish nonfiction exclusively. He's also the founder of the Creative Nonfiction Writing Program at University of Pittsburgh, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call us, 333-9455 is the number to use. We do also have a toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call, you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you might be listening on the Internet. As long as you're in the U.S., you may use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Goodkin, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
I'm doing pretty well.
Thanks for talking with us. What got you interested in, and I know this is something that you have been working on for a while, you've had the opportunity, as you explain in the book, off and on, to spend some time, particularly with one group of people working on robotic science at Carnegie Mellon. What got you interested in this area?
Well, you know, I'm a writer, and I'm always looking for subjects that I can mine that have not been mined from the inside before. And I teach at the University of Pittsburgh, and Carnegie Mellon is just a mile or so up one avenue. And the other thing that a writer always tries to do is to find a place where he or she can come and go in and out for long periods of time. And so the Robotics Institute started a long time ago, and I kind of waited for the right opportunity to go in there. And in fact, I did in 2000 or 2001, I did a national public radio interview. I went into the Robotics Center for the first time and learned about robot soccer, and I was so impressed. And I was fascinated by the people and also by the way robots played soccer that I decided this was the time to write the book. And again, you look for access and you look for interesting people and you look for something that is about at but not quite the tipping point. Yeah. And then you go.
And it's your conclusion that, in fact, you think that, and this is, as you say, this is a field, research has been going on in this field for some time, but
yes,
you think that we are at a point where perhaps we're just about, they're just about to turn a corner to get into a significant advance in where we are?
I think that if you look at what happened in the world of computers a quarter of a century or 30 years ago, people were chatting about computers. People were fascinated with the idea of word processing and computing. We're talking about in the late 60s or early 70s when the folks in Silicon Valley were just beginning to work. And so people were talking about computers, and then suddenly, without any warning, you would blink your eye, and computers have exploded throughout the world and throughout the U.S. And the Internet was something that we hardly ever talked about, and suddenly everybody was using it. And letters kind of faded from the scene, and we were communicating with email. And it wasn't a gradual thing, if you think back. It was just suddenly there. And this is exactly what's going to happen to the world of robotics much sooner than all of us think. We're talking on the telephone now about robots, but we don't understand how many robots are in our lives right at the moment, and we don't understand what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years. They are going to be pervasive, and they are going to change our lives in the same way that computers changed our lives over the past couple of decades.
I wanted to take a little time here and talk a little bit about definitions, because certainly now there are machines, mechanical devices, that are designed and programmed to do something that previously a human being did. For example, you go into a modern automobile assembly plant now, and there are machines that do things like spot welding, and we call them robots. Is that in fact correct? Is a machine that's programmed to do this repetitive action, to do this thing, which perhaps before a human did, and now we're making the machine do that, and it does that one thing, that's all it knows how to do, can't make any decisions on its own, it follows its programming. Is that in fact a robot?
Well, I mean, that's up to you to decide, but yes, I would think it is a robot. It is doing a task on its own, and you say it can't make any decisions, but I don't know about that. It's following a rule, and it's following a guideline, and my guess is that if something occurred in these single task robotic factory facilities, that if something untoward happened, the robot would stop, and so that would be another decision that the robot would make, or whatever you want to call it, the computerized machine would make. So I'm not exactly sure that they're just doing one thing without having anything else involved in it.
I guess I'm thinking about the fact that I expect that when people think about robots, they think about things that look kind of like human beings, things that have arms and legs and heads and torsos and walk, and in a sense they are an artificial person, and that they indeed have some degree of independent action and thought. That is, that there is some degree of artificial intelligence going there, and that's really what people think about. Is that the kind of thing that we really are talking about? Is that the kind of thing that we are, that people who do this kind of work are aiming for ultimately?
Ultimately, yes. Again, depending upon who those people are you're referring to, I just returned from Boston at the Robo Business Conference, and there were hundreds upon hundreds of roboticists from all across the world interested in using robotics to manufacture products and make things generally. They don't necessarily care at this point about the merging of man and machine. But most of the robotic researchers, the people who are leading the way in the robotics field, this is exactly what they are aiming at, and think that it's important to achieve this. But it's not just, I use this phrase, the merging of man and machine, and that isn't exactly what roboticists want to do. The holy grail in the world of robotics is having a robot act on its own autonomously. That seems to be autonomy, and how sophisticated that autonomy is and how close that autonomy is to a human being, that's the holy grail, and that's where most cutting-edge roboticists are moving, with all kinds of different orientations and all kinds of different creations of machines.
Yeah. That, I guess, I don't know that if I'm getting hung up on that part, but again, I'm thinking about some of the kind of devices that we have, and you have talked with people who have developed these kind of devices that are designed, the idea is that they're designed to go places where humans can't or shouldn't, and that they are things that do have ability to perceive their environment. They can see, and they can send that information back to the person who is operating them. They can move around, they can do things, and that they're directly controlled by a person who is watching a monitor that shows you what that device sees and who has some kind of control device where they can say, all right, now I want you to move to the right. Now I want you to go up 2 inches. Now I want you to go back. Now I want you to go over and pick up that rock that you see over there to your right. And that something that is directly controlled by a person, that does indeed qualify as a robot. And yet what we're really thinking, what we're looking ahead to, the idea is that something like that could actually be on its own, make kind of decisions on its own if it was in a situation where you couldn't have a direct link or you couldn't have direct oversight by a human being.
There are robots just the way you have described them. This is true. Many robots are acting on a semi-autonomous basis, but being controlled by some sort of a human presence or human operator. But on the other hand, that's not necessarily where the world of robotics is going. The world of robotics is moving to the point where the robot will not be controlled or influenced at all by a human operator. And so Spirit and Opportunity, the two robots currently prowling on Mars right now, they practice a very limited kind of autonomy. The scientists at NASA will tell Spirit and Opportunity what they want them to do. Okay, they are not driving them. They're not remote controlling them with the joystick. They could, but they're not doing that. They will send a program or send a detailed message to Spirit and Opportunity and tell them what they want them to do, and then Spirit and Opportunity will do it without any influence or involvement by the operator or the scientist or engineer at NASA. So that's kind of a limited kind of autonomy. But there are also many robots that will leave its human, let us say, master and explore, dodging barriers, climbing hills, making decisions about where to go and what to do without any connection or communication to a human being.
Our guest, Lee Goodkind, he's the author of many books, including one we're talking about here this morning, Almost Human, Making Robots Think. It is published by W.W. Norton, has recently come out. He's the editor of Creative Nonfiction. That's the first literary journal to publish nonfiction exclusively. He's also the founder of the Creative Nonfiction Writing Program at University of Pittsburgh. He's joining us by phone. We have a couple of callers here. We want to certainly welcome people into the conversation. You have questions for our guest. You want to join in? You can certainly do that by calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here calling from Paxton on our line 4, toll-free line. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. I'm fighting laryngitis here, so I'll make it real quick and ring off.
Okay.
Very interesting. I was wondering if your guest could comment on the progress and the sensitivity of robots. And what I'm thinking about here is explosive defusement, like the Army uses. I believe the Army still uses real people for, like, landmines. And is there any progress as far as firefighting where a robot would go into an extremely dangerous situation to put a fire out? And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
Okay.
I have to say that I made a decision to stay away from military-oriented robotics in writing this book. So I can't speak with a great deal of knowledge. It was just something. You can't write about all robots, and that was just a decision I made. So I don't know whether there are robots that will handle explosives, nor do I know that there will robots that will fight fires. But I can be fairly certain that the technology exists to make that happen. For example, right after the Kew Creek mine disaster, where 9 miners were trapped for nearly a couple of days in a mine, some of the folks at Carnegie Mellon got really interested in seeing what they could do to kind of make this not happen again, and they created a robot called Groundhog, which has been able to enter abandoned and sometimes partially flooded mines on its own autonomously and find its way in, and around and through all of the many corridors of the mine, and then return and map the mine so that people will be able to see what is around and be able, and it would be make it possible to avoid what happened to Q Creek, which was they had very inaccurate maps, and so when they began mining a nearby mine, the walls caved, and it caused the flooding, and it caused the commotion. So that's possible. So it would seem to me that that getting a robot into a fire and triggering some firefighting equipment is not very far away. There are also robots that right now, very successfully, that are commercial robots that will autonomously scrape paint from the hulls of ships, large ships, and then repaint those ships all autonomously on its own. So that has happened, and so it seems to me that firefighting and even military-oriented applications handling explosives can't be too far behind.
Yeah. It is mostly the kind of research that we've been talking about here devoted to building some kind of device for working in hazardous environments where human beings either can't go or where it's extremely difficult and extremely risky for them to go.
I wouldn't say most of the research is being directed in that direction, but there is some research. Of course, the obvious thing, Spirit and Opportunity are on Mars because it's a heck of a lot safer for robots to be on Mars than human beings at this particular time. And again, Groundhog is mapping mines because men would be crazy to go into mines that may well be partially flooded. And so robots are doing that. Robots are going where men and women should not necessarily go, or would be in some respects wasting their time by going. For example, robots now are in hospitals, nurse bots, and nurse bots will deliver medications from the pharmacy to different patients in different parts of the hospital. Now, humans can certainly do that, but it's such an easy thing to do, and a human being might be able to be used in a much more complicated and challenging role than walking through the hallway and dropping off medication. So there's a robot being able to do that on its own and kind of serve society and also free up other people to do more important things.
We have some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana. And this is line one.
Oh, yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
On the autonomous nature of robots, I was thinking about the adaptive algorithms that these engineers use to, where the machine, in a sense, has used the word think.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you differentiate between the software portion of the programming, where the programming of the the machine being the machine, the software being the intelligence, as you might want to call it. And I remember when IBM built Big Blue to the computer that played Kasparov in the World Chess Championship. Well, not a chess championship, it is sort of like a bet that they could beat him.
It's a big face-off.
Yeah, and I remember Kasparov said after he lost and sort of stomped off, but he said, I read an interview with him, he said it was extremely creepy because he thought the machine, he spoke of the machine like it was a person, which, of course, is probably his approach to it. But I'm just curious as to, do you think, I'm sure that the thinking portion will be entirely software. Do you think that will happen, a computer will pass the Turing test in the next 20 years? You know that?
Well, let me go back to Kasparov for a second. Kasparov was, it is in fact kind of creepy to be able to communicate or not communicate with a computer or with a robot. And everyone always says that although Kasparov lost, he could go home and make some scrambled eggs for dinner. And Big Blue could not do that. And so there is a big difference between in a big gap and in some ways almost a disconnect between what they call the hardware portion of robotics and the software portion of robotics. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you go into a robotics center, there is kind of a subtle tension between those folks, the engineers who build the computer, who build the robots, and those other folks who make the robots think, who write the software. And interestingly enough, over the past 20 or 25 years, the engineers, the hardware folks, were the people much more in control of the robotics world. And as computers became much more powerful and much more sophisticated, the software folks began taking over. And now in most sophisticated robotics centers, you'll see a few engineers, but many, many more people who are writing the software and helping the robots determine whether how clearly, and helping the robots think more clearly, or following a set of rules that roboticists are laying down.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. I was always wondering. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wasn't quite sure exactly how these centers work. I mean, like, you know, NASA or something. But, hey, thanks a lot, David. It's a great show. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Well, let's go on here to another caller, and this would be line number two, and someone on the cell phone. Hello.
Hello. I was listening to you talk about the robot going through the mines and finding its way and
yes,
going through water and dangerous situations. And it occurred to me that in the process of doing that, the computer or the robot has to be told to avoid some things in order to get to certain places, to avoid damaging itself and, you know, not destroying itself. And I wonder, it makes me go to the next step then, when does the computer refuse to give its existence up? Is there such a thing? I mean, where it says, I can't do that because I will destroy myself. And there's been Star Trek things on that sort of thing and that sort of conclusion. But I was wondering if there's anything, any discussions about that in the real world. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, let me answer that in two ways. One way is, you're so right. In the world of robotics, which are robotics being, you know, kind of operated and pushed almost all the time by computers, when the computer gets annoyed, when the computer can't seem to be able to do what the roboticist or the robot is asking it to do, the computer does what it does in your living room or in your office. It just crashes. It just stops. And that's always a problem because a robot that is autonomous, say in the middle of a mine or down underwater, when a computer crashes, it is very difficult to be able to restart the computer. So it certainly rebels on that very basic idea, and remind me what the other part of the question was.
Well, it seemed it went to the issue of, is it, can you imagine one of these machines being instructed to go into a situation that would likely result in its destruction? The machine would say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go and get wrecked. I'm not going to go in there. I'm just going to sit right here and not do anything, or I'm going to turn around and go back. I suppose this gets at the issue of this question that people like to think about, and I think it's a very interesting question about consciousness, and are we ever going to end up with artificial intelligence at that kind of level where we have machine consciousness and have a machine that actually has a sense of itself and may also have a sense of wanting to preserve its own existence?
You know, we forget that these machines, if you want to call them machines, roboticists don't like necessarily calling robots machines, but we forget that these robots are programmed by people, by human beings who are writing the programs. And they do think about these issues. What happens if a robot is put into a dangerous situation? And while it's true that a robot will, a sophisticated robot will be able to think for itself, the programs kind of accommodate the robot. So, for example, if we go back to that groundhog mind mapping robot, it doesn't see the world like you see or I see the world. It sees the world through kind of a checkerboard called a cost map, and every few yards as or a few seconds as it moves through the mine, the cost of moving forward is radiated right into its right in front of it, and it makes a decision based upon kind of I'm being elementary about this, but it makes a decision based upon the safety that is being computed in this checkerboard kind of square. And so, for example, it may well mean that gray will mean clear sailing in the mine, and green or black may mean you better stop. And then there are shadings in checkerboard boxes in between that point that will communicate back to the robot and give the robot this kind of a safety net. Should I move forward? The robot will ask itself. Or is this block show me that it is too dangerous? And if it is too dangerous, well, then I'm going to do what I've been programmed to do, which is to either shut down or to turn and reverse and go in another way. So the robots are, in fact, programmed by human beings who also seem to understand that it can get to a point where the danger is overwhelming.
Yeah, and certainly it would make sense that you would want the machine to be programmed in such a way so that if it was not under your direct control, it wouldn't do something. I mean, you wouldn't want it to do something that would lead to its eventual destruction. That wouldn't make a whole lot of sense, particularly if you had spent a lot of time and effort in designing this machine, and it was a prototype. You don't want it to go and jump it off a cliff.
Right, and it won't. I mean, well, it might, but if the program is right, it won't. But, you know, it's interesting. We can only, at this particular, we're talking about how sophisticated robots are, and you may think that I'm very confident about robots and very positive about how sophisticated robots are. But at the on the other extreme, although a robot will do exactly what I said it will do, it will cross a desert and on its own, autonomously, and it will dodge boulders, and it will go up and down hills, and it will stop when there's a gigantic gully that makes it dangerous for it to go forward. It will do all of that. But on the other hand, robots are also not nearly as sophisticated as human beings. So, for example, if the robot is going through the mine and suddenly comes upon a towel, a piece of cloth hanging directly in front of its way of movement, it will not look and say to itself, "Wow, there's a towel, a piece of cloth. I think I'll just go forward." Because we would know that we could just move the cloth away; it wouldn't hurt us, and go forward. A robot doesn't know a difference between a brick, a pizza, or a piece of cloth. It will see this barrier. And if the barrier covers up the way forward too much, it will simply stop or turn around and go in the opposite direction. It is not that sophisticated to recognize what objects are, only that those objects are there, and once an object is there, that it might be dangerous and might hurt them.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful example of how something that to us might seem to be a very simple task to assess a situation and decide what we do about it, and particularly decide is this a barrier that we can surmount or not, that to us that seems very simple, but to design a machine that can make that assessment is actually very difficult.
Right.
We're a bit past our midpoint here. Lee Gutkind is our guest. He's the author of many books, and the one we're talking about here this morning, his most recent, is Almost Human, Making Robots Think. It is published by W.W. Norton and is based on some of his time that he spent over the years talking with, getting to know people who work at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. He is, in addition to being the author of all these books, he's the editor of Creative Nonfiction. It's the first literary journal to publish nonfiction exclusively. He's also the founder of the Creative Nonfiction Writing Program at University of Pittsburgh. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, if you talked about the fact that perhaps over time in this field there have at times been some tension between the hardware guys and the software guys, between those people who were, as I think of it, who were mechanical engineers, who were thinking about how do we we build the physical device that we need? What kind of machinery do we need? And then the people who work on the software who think about, well, what kind of programming does this have to be able to do the tasks that we want? If you look at those two tasks, obviously both of them are difficult. You can see, for example, that to build a machine that kind of looks like a person that can climb stairs without falling over turns out to be pretty difficult. So you don't want to minimize the difficulty of the mechanical engineering challenges. On the other hand, we are still a long, long way from having anything like artificial intelligence. So the thinking part of it is also very difficult. Is it possible to say one or the other of those two major challenges is the more difficult?
I don't think so. I think that they're both incredibly difficult. I mean, to create, let us say, a mechanical man. Osimo, the probably the most human-like robot ever made, the one that's made by Honda, can climb stairs and can do a little dance and sometimes can and can jog and can sometimes and shake your hand. Its fingers and hands have 25 or 30 different kinds of ways of movement. But it certainly can do very little on its own. But just creating that mechanical marvel took one of the largest corporations in the world decades to do, and millions upon millions of dollars. It's an incredibly challenging kind of thing, and as I said, it still can't think like the robots who play soccer that are much smaller. They're both very, very difficult, right, challenges, and it seems like the corporations and the universities working in robotics are moving either in one direction or the other. It's very expensive and very time-consuming to be able to move both at the same time. So Carnegie Mellon is very, very software-oriented, whereas there are other programs that are run more by engineers, like the program at Cornell, that are much more hardware-oriented. But all of this will, at some point, and slowly but surely, even now, the roboticists in the hardware folks and the software folks, or what people call the gearheads and the eggheads, will slowly but surely come together for the sense of the common good of robotics. And one of the reasons that the world of robotics has taken so long to grow is because of this rift between the hardware and the software people, and because that for a long time in the 1970s and in the 1980s, they did not want to work together because they're very different people. Engineers generally are very conservative and kind of try to make certain that someone told me that engineers are devoted to making sure their careers go on for a long time without them being responsible for any major disaster. Whereas the software folks are quite cavalier. They're quite adventurous, and probably they're adventurous because most of the things they end up doing, at least initially, are done on the computer and proven through simulation rather than through real life.
Let's talk with another caller, someone in Chicago, line 4.
Thank you very much.
Yes, hello.
The aspect of all this application and use of the robots, assembly lines, computers, etc., it reminds me of the human element that is being displaced economically and the consequence and fallout as a result of that upon our economic system and our way of life. And I wanted to maybe perhaps comment on that. However, when we consider robots and other applications, we have them now being utilized in nanotechnology, medical areas, as well as flying, takeoff, flying and landing airplanes, all the way to outer space. So the whole horizon is just going to be unlimited for us to apply that. But the human aspect and economic ramifications have yet to be dealt with, and I think it can be very much like an earthquake and shaking things up. Can you comment on that?
I had somewhat trouble hearing you, but I think I get the gist of what you're saying, and I will comment because I think that's a really important thing that the world of roboticist world is not yet dealing with. I think that you are right. and that once robots become pervasive, even more so than now, say 5 to 10 years from now, it is really going to shake up our economy and shake up the way in which really cause an incredible impact on the way in which we live, especially for those people who support themselves, whether they're students or the elderly, through kind of menial or manual labor jobs. There will be a point very soon, and it's going to be in a blink of the eye, when robots will be cleaning our houses. Robots, gigantic vacuum cleaners, will be cleaning up public buildings. Robots will be working in McDonald's. This will all, and robots, as I said, will be in nursing homes and also be able to do some nursing care for patients. This is all going to happen very soon, and society is not being prepared for it now. We do not know. No one is sitting down, and the robotics world is not communicating with the public, the people upon whom the impact will come through robotics, about what they intend to do and what's going to happen to the world once robots do become pervasive. And I think it's important that in one way or the other, we all sit down and begin to analyze what the impact of robotics is going to be on society. Is it going to make us lazier, for example? College people who go to college, are they going to be able to find jobs to support themselves? And how are we going to be able to account for it, worry about that now 10 years from now? And what about the elderly? In Japan especially, and also in Korea, robots are now being designed, and they're publicly talking about robots being companions to the elderly. Well, how long will it be until there will be houses, hospitals, corridors of elderly people unable to take care of themselves, who are going to be taken care of almost exclusively by robots? That's certainly a possibility, and we need to think now about how, whether we want that possibility, whether elderly people want to be cared for by robots, and what we're going to do to make sure that that won't happen. And even further down the line, once robots become able to be our personal assistants and companions, and again, we're not that far away from that at this particular time, think about some of the legal and moral ramifications. What happens if a robot bumps into your next-door neighbor, knocks your next-door neighbor over, and breaks its leg? Who's responsible for that injury? Is it the robot, or is it the owner of the robot? These are all things that we need to begin to talk about now, and nobody is talking about it.
Yeah, we need some creative fiction applied to those matters. Thank you very much.
Right, sure. Thanks. Well, it strikes me the basic kind of questions that you've been asking and the concerns that you've been voicing and that some people voice. People have been voicing those concerns and asking those questions probably ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and that the machine has not completely replaced human beings yet. It seems to me that the level of machine competence that we're talking about seems so remote that it almost makes it hard to imagine that we would see such a thing within the next 50 to 100 years. Is the field really moving that quickly so that we could conceivably see such a thing happen within decades, perhaps?
Well, again, whoever imagined what was going to happen when computers became pervasive?
Hmm.
I mean, the whole world has been changed by computers. Who ever imagined that we wouldn't be going into libraries anymore? We would be researching almost exclusively online. It's very hard to predict what's going to happen, and the breakthroughs in technology come in an explosive manner. And if you're right, if it's not going to happen, if what I'm saying is not going to happen within the next 50 years, then I hope that's true, because now's the time to begin to plan for what may well be a significant change in our society in the next 15 years. Frankly, I think it's going to happen much, much more quickly than anybody ever imagines.
Let's talk with someone else here on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. So to me, it seems that the word robot itself is sort of what evokes in people's minds the sort of science fiction and horror. The advent of computers, yes, they have dramatically changed our lives, but they certainly haven't taken anything over. And, you know, when computers were first coming out, obviously people feared the takeover of the world by these artificially intelligent devices. I just wonder if you could comment on the origin of the word robot itself, and does that sort of bring back anything that sort of explains why people equate the term robotics, which is essentially just computerized mechatronics, with some artificially intelligent adversarial entity.
I wish I could remember the name of the playwright who first, I'm kind of glancing through my book as I'm talking here, who first kind of named robots and what the meaning of robots are. I can't remember, but it was a play that had a lot to do with human beings taking human beings creating these mechanical marvels and gradually and slowly but surely creating armies of mechanical men that would fight one another, and eventually the armies of mechanical men took over the world.
I'm here with the nod to Wikipedia. It says here that the word was introduced by a Czech writer in
yes.
a play, was written in 1920, and that it comes apparently from the noun robota, that means labor or drudgery in Czech and other Slavic languages. So it goes back apparently to 1920.
Interesting. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Although I guess within literature, mythology, popular culture, folk belief, the idea of creating an artificial human being is actually very, very old.
That's right.
It goes back a long time as both something to be desired and attempted, and also as both something as something to be feared. It's a very old notion, and certainly when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, that was not the first time that anybody had thought about constructing an artificial human. So that and its attendant fears, it's not new.
And the fears, roboticists do not scheme in order to make an artificial human being in order to take over the world. This isn't in any way, shape, or form what roboticists are about. It's all about the obsession of the technology and seeing how far they can push the technology and how much they can make the technology do, not to take over from human beings, but to serve human beings. And that's really a really important thing to say. And I don't think anybody wants to create armies of men and robotic men and women to take over our jobs and to fight our wars. What I think roboticists are doing, as most engineers and scientists want to do, is to try to find a way to better the world.
Hmm.
And I haven't mentioned one other thing that I think was really interesting in my in my research at Carnegie Mellon.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I feel that this is really something that's going to impact upon the future. When I went to Carnegie Mellon, I thought I would find lots of folks who were lots of distinguished old gray-haired scientists and engineers who had been in the world of robotics and in science for a long, long time. And in fact, what startled me so much is how young the robotics world is. And almost all of the software written in related to all of the robots that I have written about, these robots that play soccer, the robots that go into mine, the nursing robots, the robots that have become scientists and explore deserts, almost all of that software is written almost by people who are children, by people under 25 years of age, sometimes under 20 years of age. They are the people powering this robotics movement. The technology is all in the hands of very experimental, very obsessed, very energetic young people, mostly men, who are kind of feeling their way in a very brilliant and in some cases undirected way.
Well, just to go back to something we were talking about before, I asked the question about which of the two challenges, the hardware, the software, were more difficult, and your answer was, well, really, they're both difficult. You can't really say that one is more difficult than the other. But if you then ask the question, well, if we are indeed at a tipping point here and we can expect in the relatively near future to see big advances in robotics, what brings that about? It sounds as if the answer to that question is our increasing sophistication, our increasing ability to do software, the advances in computer technology, the fact that we can put more and more computing power into a smaller package, and that we are learning a little bit more about what the nature of thinking is. Again, not that we're anywhere near truly solving the problems of artificial intelligence, but we have gotten better at that, and that maybe if you ask this question, what enables the big advances in robotics, maybe it is what has happened recently on the software side.
Well, I think that's right. And at this particular moment, the software is not that sophisticated that we need sophisticated mechanical devices. For example, most roboticists today are using robots or using vehicles or machines that we can all buy. For the past 2 years, there was this big Mojave Desert autonomous race of vehicles from supposed to be from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, called the DARPA Challenge Race, and that was 250 miles, and it was kind of modified to be 135 miles. And initially, all of the major corporations and the major research institutions began working on this, decided that they would create their own vehicle to ride through the desert and to do this autonomously, no drivers. But in the end, almost all of them took existing vehicles like Volkswagens and Hummers or Humvees or other four-wheel drive vehicles and applied and added high-powered computers and wrote software and used these vehicles as they stand, as you and I could buy them off the showroom shelf. In order to make these races possible. And in fact, a Volkswagen Touareg that was modified by Stanford University's robotics lab won the race. 135 miles, averaged about 30 miles an hour on its own across the desert, dodging rocks and ravines and surviving. So in some respects, I think what's going to happen is as the software becomes more sophisticated, then the engineers are going to have to find more sophisticated ways to accommodate the software folks. But at this particular time, a lot of it is not happening.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here in Clinton, line 4. Hello. They're called there on line 4? No, I guess we lost him. Well, as somebody wants to call real quick, we have a couple of minutes here to get in some more callers. Our guest is Lee Goodkind. He is the author of the book Almost Human, Making Robots Think, which is based on his experiences getting to know and observing over a period of years some of the folks who work at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. The book is published by W.W. Norton, and it is out just recently. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just we're almost to the point where we have to finish. We have maybe about 2 minutes left. Just tell me about the coolest thing that you saw in all of this time.
I was in the Atacama Desert, which is the place on Earth in Chile, the place on Earth most like Mars. It hadn't rained in the Atacama in 100 years. And I was with Zoe the robot. And the whole idea with Zoe was kind of to create the new robot, the robot to take the place of Spirit and Opportunity, a robot that can literally discover signs of life, not just water, but signs of life. And Robot and Zoe, this autonomous robot, went about 200 kilometers on its own, and at one particular point it stopped. It kind of looked around the terrain. It went directly to a place where it found bacteria and chlorophyll and determined that there was some sort of life form there all by itself. And then through a device that utilized fluorescent dye, determined the kind of life that it was, sign of life, that was apparent there. It did it all by itself, and it took all of this information, plus very, very beautiful images, and sent it back to the scientists at Carnegie Mellon who were waiting for it.
Well, there, I think that we will have to finish up because we've come here to the end of the time. And it's a very interesting book. And certainly, if you'd like to read more about work in the area of robotics and what is going on now and what scientists in this area hope one day to be able to achieve, you can look for this book that we have talked about. The title is Almost Human, Making Robots Think, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest, Lee Goodkind. He is, in addition to being the author of this and other books, the editor of Creative Nonfiction, the first literary journal to publish nonfiction exclusively. He's also the founder of the Creative Nonfiction Writing Program at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It was a pleasure.